gentle man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan, 'cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand. And what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying. Think for yourself, little girl. Don't let them tell you how to run your world, 'cause everyone's the same, choking back that nervous hurl. And if they tell you they ain't, well, they're just lying. Yeah, they're just lying.
Well, a very hearty welcome to you. You've tuned in to
what show is this?
It's a show called Thinking Clearly, and it's a show about critical thinking and related topics.
Oh, wow. And you must be our host, Bob Frelick.
I am, and you must be
Julia Minton.
All right. We're here to keep you on the edge of your seats and thinking critically for about an hour. And I'll kind of tell you what the topic is that we're going to focus on tonight. In fact, I'm going to first, though, tell you a little bit about how you can contact us,
mm-hmm.
because we need it. You know, we need structure. We need comments from our listeners. It's really great to get people's reaction. And so
find us on Facebook, Thinking Clearly Radio Show. You just type that in your little search bar, like our page, stay up to date with our awesome promos and various other supplemental information we post on Facebook there. And you can find us podcasting. We are syndicated podcasting, so maybe you want to listen to us again or check out our the archive of our back shows. You can, if you have a podcast app, which I do, I just go to add feed and I type in Thinking Clearly and it pops right up and I just hit subscribe. But you can also go to thinkingclearly.libsyn.com.
Yeah.
That's thinkingclearly.libsyn, LIBSYN.com. And you can find the entire archive of our show there. And this show will be up within moments.
And they can listen or download. So that's how you can make this as interactive as we would really hope that it will be.
And we really couldn't do it without our listening audience and the community of critical thinkers.
And I know that I've read our working definition. I'm no longer calling this a definition. I'm calling it a description. It's too long to be a definition, so it's more of a description. And I'm not going to read the whole description.
I love how it evolves, too. As we learn more.
Exactly.
It grows.
It does. And when the topics come out in the show that is not part of our description, then, well, we add that to our description. And actually, it's worked out really good, the organic process in action. But I will read the part that relates to what we're going to talk about tonight. It says, critical thinking also includes an awareness of an attempt to compensate for the vulnerabilities we all have in our thought processes, including cognitive biases such as confirmation bias. And that's a big part of what we're going to discuss tonight.
I attempt to compensate for vulnerabilities all the time.
Well, I like the way you say attempt. It is, because we're going to talk about that. You know, we are not always in critical thinking mode.
Mm-mm.
Sometimes Julia and I get in discussions after the show. We did that last month. And I had to email her and apologize for my vehemency, my passion in the argument that we were talking about, the discussion that we had, because I realized I wasn't really being a very good critical thinker at that point. I was trying to get my point across as strongly as I could. I was trying to persuade. I was trying to, you know, and I felt a little bad about that.
Oh, it was a great conversation. I always enjoy our second show when the mics are off. And maybe I should be the one apologizing for throwing things. No, I didn't throw anything.
All right.
But passion is, I mean, here we are a month later. And just because we had a passionate discussion over a topic that is important to us doesn't mean we can't sit back down and have another great discussion this month.
Yeah. And that's what it's all about. And that's actually another part of our definition. So since we're talking about it or description, I'm going to read that too. When communicating our ideas using critical thinking, we are willing to acknowledge and evaluate evidence that may be contrary to our conclusions and consider alternative conclusions and beliefs. That's the part I violated last month. But so we can't always be in critical thinking modes.
Nor should we.
Sometimes we want to get out there and we want to get our argument out as strongly as we can. We may even want to use rhetoric and all kinds of different persuasive techniques. The important thing is to become aware of what your goals are. Mm-hmm. Because if your goals are to get closer and closer and closer to the truth, that's more what fits into the definition of critical thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. There's a time and place for many different types of communication, different types of thinking. So I think it's not reasonable to expect us to be always rational or always in critical thinking mode. It's not what the entirety of the human experience is about. But yeah. When we do it, you know, hopefully we can do it well.
Yeah, and be aware of what mode you're in. I think that's important because sometimes people think they're in a critical thinking mode. They think they're rationally gathering evidence, evaluating the evidence, evaluating the logic involved, and the kinds of things that we talk about in critical thinking. And they will say to people, well, I critically thought about that issue, but they really didn't. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were confirming a bias, maybe that they had, and they were cherry picking the evidence, looking for the evidence that supports what they mm-hmm. believe, and discarding mm-hmm. or minimalizing the evidence that is contrary to mm-hmm. that.
So, and I also find these days, you know, I get into conversations with friends and folks where their intention is not to get into a critical thinking. It's more to commiserate. And I'm not always quick to catch on to that because there is something different about just let's commiserate about the time and the world that we live in.
You know what I think about that? Hmm. I think if you commiserate with people, you're just both co-miserable.
All right, well, save my commiserating for somebody else then.
No, I know that that has its purpose. Or preaching to the choir, you know.
I'm a great preacher.
Yeah, that has its purpose. You don't want to get into critical thinking when you're talking to the troops to try to motivate them to take the hill.
No, that's motivational rhetoric. That's what we want there.
Exactly. So, it depends on what your goal is. Right. Well, the topic for tonight, we're going to be reviewing and discussing topics that are, as we already talked about, pretty important to our survival in this current information environment, which I would go so far to say is a polluted environment and is becoming more and more so.
Well, and that's where we can play our part to not add to the pollution.
Oh, I'm going to advocate for that tonight. And we're going to start by reviewing some of what happens when we're exposed to information, specifically, and we're going to throw out these words, motivated reasoning, heuristics, one of my favorite words. I just love to say that.
Starts with an H.
Yeah, and biases. And then we're going to move to a discussion of some aspects of the mindset and attitudes that are important in critical thinking and the strategies for overcoming those preset biases. What do you think you call that strategy?
De-biasing.
Isn't that a cool word? De-biasing.
It's a lot of vowels.
And you know what? I looked into that and the research on that and that kind of thing, and there's not much research on it. It's kind of a new field. It's used somewhat in business and corporations.
Well, but when I went researching de-biasing, you're right. I came up there's a lot less about de-biasing than biases.
Oh, yes.
And a lot of the resources I were turning up were actually from business schools. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, of course, who would be the most motivated to de-bias? It's people who want to make some money.
Sure. And if you're brainstorming ideas and that kind of thing, you want to de-bias. You want to get trapped in as many ideas as you can. So you want to get rid of some of those biases so that people are more able to think out of the box or mm-hmm. think creatively. Or if you're hiring people, you know, you want to get rid of your biases. I remember I got a job once. This was way back when I was a chemist, and I got hired in a pharmaceutical company, a small pharmaceutical company. It wasn't Monsanto. We were trying to find anti-cancer drugs and that kind of stuff. We were the good guys. And the guy who hired me after I worked there for about a month or two, he said, you know, we interviewed a lot of people for this job, but one of the reasons that I decided to hire you is because you came from a state university. You got your master's degree at a state university, and that kind of threw me. And I said, you know, because he said, we had a lot of people from the UCs, but those people usually are very theoretical and not as practical and that kind of thing. And we need somebody who's hands-on, practical in this position. And he said, the reason is that I've hired two or three people from the UC system in other jobs, and that's the way they turned out. So he was biased against UC candidates, and I got the job because I wasn't a UC candidate, which is really a
works for
amazing.
You.
It worked for me.
Bummer for the other guys.
Yeah, too bad for them. So at any rate, that's what we're up to tonight, and we're going to throw in a little bonus feature, which is going to be we're going to give you. We tried to on this show to give you some real life kinds of things that you can do and try, right? Because we can sit around and whine about how we're vulnerable cognitively and all this kind of thing. Quite a bit, and yet you go, well, okay, that's great. Now I believe that I'm cognitively vulnerable. What do I do about it? So besides debiasing, we're gonna share some personal kind of ideas and strategies that we have in dealing with information. So it's going to be a big show, lots of different topics, which we'll probably get through maybe half of. Anyway, that's what we're up to tonight. What I wanted to do to start with is, because we've talked about all these issues kind of separately, I wanted to kind of in one fell swoop sort of give the big picture of what this means, what biases are. We've talked about system one, system two, and that kind of thing. And I want to just have a discussion. I'll throw some stuff out and we can discuss it about the big picture of cognition. This is kind of I'm not going to cite any research studies or anything. I'm just going to, in pretty jargon-free terms as I can, paint the picture of where cognitive science is at this particular time in terms of the research that's going on and how it relates to critical thinking. And we've talked about this before, but it's amazing how right Sigmund Freud was. You know, he talked about the unconscious, mm-hmm. right? Now, he talked about repression and that kind of thing. And there was a pendulum swing away from unconscious towards more conscious cognitive processes in psychology after Freud. But they're vindicating a lot of Freud in that some will say all of our thoughts, our mental processes, our cognition is below the level, the threshold of consciousness. Mm-hmm. It's not got the spotlight of consciousness in it. So this is what we have referred to in previous shows as the intuitive, sometimes called fast thinking, System one, it's called. It goes by various different names. And this all is what we call the dual process theory of cognition. One of those dual processes is this intuitive fast system one thinking, where we deal with an issue on a less than conscious way. It's like a black box. In comes the information, out comes the answer, the decision, the behavior, whatever. And this was all evolutionarily programmed into us for survival, right? You've talked about that before.
Oh, certainly, yeah. And it's not that it's processes that have served us in achieving survival. You know, we don't gain these processes like, oh, I'm gonna do this now because I'm gonna have a better chance of living. It's because we do those things we end up having a better chance of living, and then they kind of stick. And when you say system one, system two, we're kind of talking about a sort of a multifaceted descriptive system, not like an actual mapped out nervous system one or something like that, that we discussed in one book, Thinking Fast and Slow, kind of describing system one and system two, the intuitive fast approach. I imagine it sort of like I kind of imagine the future of self-driving cars, but you can sit where the driver's seat is and you can kind of feel like you're in control, that you're in the seat, that, you know, there are pedals there if you wanted to push them, or maybe you are pushing them, but really you're kind of on autopilot for the most part. And, you know, it's stuff like when I get out of bed in the morning, I assume gravity's there. I don't have to rethink it every time I wake up. It's a simple assumption I make because it's always been that way.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's amazing how much of our life and our behavior and our thoughts and our decisions are made at that automatic kind of level. And the cognitive science has, and neuroscience with fMRI imaging and all kinds of different technology, has really provided quite a bit of support for that much of our behavior and even our opinions and reactions, our moral judgments, mm-hmm. are made in that emotionally, and that system one is strongly connected to associative memory, in other words, associations and memories that we have, mm-hmm. and to our emotions. And the second system is the more rational, analytical, deliberative system. And that's that we have been referring to as system two. And so that's the dual process model. Now, if you take this and fine grain it, in other words, you know, you go, you zoom down, you zoom in and say, okay, well, how does that happen? Well, cognitive science believes at this point, the consensus is the brain and the mind are the same thing. There's not anything separate up about the mind. It's just two, when you use the term mind, it's a way of talking about what the brain can do.
Well, I'm just going to throw this monkey wrench in there. Don't you think it's fair to say it's a little bit more than the brain?
I would say, in my opinion, I would say that it is just a different way of talking about what the brain can do. Hmm. I'm very much a naturalist. I don't see anything else or evidence for anything else, and I think that's the consensus. You know, it used to be with Descartes. He thought there were, this was the dual model, the dualistic model.
The body and the soul.
Right. He thought that the brain was part of the body, but there was a separate plane of existence, which was, and he called that the soul. That's pretty much lost support from cognitive science and science in general. And I think, and so I'm just painting the picture here from the realm of cognitive science.
Well, I think it's really interesting you went there because that's a little more far out than I was thinking. I actually meant more like the nervous system, that the brain isn't isolated. The brain is connected to the circuitry, for lack of a better word. And that when we say, so you went really far out.
I did. Far out.
I didn't expect that.
Far out.
But that, it's been popular to equate the mind with the brain. Which is this thing in our head. But the brain, in fact, is attached to our nervous system, which we're discovering, our lungs and our guts and all our organs are actually playing a little bit more of a part of in the nervous system. I am so not a biologist. Okay.
Thank you for grounding me. I was far out. Yes. But
we can do
okay.
That on another show.
That's okay. Definitely. When I say brain, I don't mean just what's in our head. I mean,
there's our eyes. And...
Oh, sure. There's a whole thing called embodiment.
Mm-hmm.
embodied intelligence that takes into consideration everything that our body does, and mm-hmm. that we learn through interacting with our environment and our body. Through our touching it and our senses and stuff. So when I say brain and mind is the same thing, I'm talking about, when I say brain, I'm talking about everything that is interconnected with our brain in one way or the other.
Which is
everything in our body for the most part.
And maybe some stuff outside of our body, but we're not so sure about that.
Well, I'm pretty
I just
sure.
want to avoid the sim- I want to avoid the simplistic, because sometimes people say, your brain isn't, you don't live inside your head, your brain isn't everything. And I think it's important to kind of update that model a little bit, in that now what we're talking about is our mind, is our body, what I just heard you say.
Well, no, what I'm saying actually is when I say brain, I'm talking about our neurons in our skull and our spine, and all of our nerves, which peripheral nerves, which go through the body. I'm talking about all of that and everything that connects to that. I'm talking about that takes into consideration hormones, which can affect us, our behavior and that sort of thing. So that's what I'm talking about when I say brain. I mean all of that. When I say mind, what I'm talking about is what our brain can do, just speaking about it at a higher level. So when I'm talking about our mind, we can have motivation. Okay? Mm-hmm. We can be motivated to do something, strongly motivated to do something. That would be a mind function, which is caused by something that's happening in our brain. So when I say the brain and the mind are the same, it's just that they're the same thing, but we're talking about two different levels. So if we zoom down to what's happening in the brain, then if we're talking about mind, we're talking about our thoughts, our beliefs, our behaviors, our emotions, those kinds of things. That's at the level of mind. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, if we zoom in and say, well, how does that occur? Now we're going to talk about the details of the brain. And the details of the brain is the workhorse of the brain, of course, is the neuron. Mm-hmm. And the neuron has the ability to pass information through electrochemical signals down the neuron, and it gets information from other neurons and passes them on to other neurons. And there's an incredible interconnection between those neurons. And this is what, according to the current sort of consensus within psychology, cognitive science, neuroscience, this is what leads to the kind of complexity in our behavior, our cognitive processes, this incredible amount of interconnection between those neurons. Mm-hmm. And the neurons themselves can be modified, and the neurotransmitters that are the chemical messengers that pass the signal from one nerve to cell to another, those play a part too, a mm-hmm. substantial part. So it's an incredibly complex information processing system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It almost sounds like the brain, sort of like the central processing unit of our body, that is kind of the computer with these different components. Because what I hear you saying is that, we're talking about brain and neurons and neurotransmitters. And to me, that also sounds like what happens in the background of when I get like butterflies in my stomach because I'm nervous or upset about something. I may say I have butterflies in my stomach, but you're talking about the mind. Did I get that right?
Yeah, your mind is interpreting something that's happening in your body. Mm-hmm. But it's doing that through the interconnectivity of the neurons. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And those neurons, you can sense those stomach acid buildup and the kinds of things that give you that feeling. Not actual butterflies. So at any rate, so we can look at the larger, at one level, look at the mind and what the brain can do, and then neuroscience and is beginning to look in detail about how it's done by our neurons and interconnections with our hormones and all that kind of thing. In fact, they're just like a genome, they're trying to map all the connections, to come up with a map of all the interconnections in maybe a simple organism, and that's called a connectome. And it's a great project that's underway now. It's going to take years and years and years to ever get any headway on that in terms of human beings, but they are beginning to map out simpler the nervous system of simple animals, like the worm, a tiny worm called C. elegans, I think that's elegans, who only has, that little tiny worm has 302 approximately neurons or nerve cells in it.
I think I killed that many last week.
So you'd think that would be simple, but still, to figure out the interconnections there, or to figure out how that tiny worm's behaviors map to the interconnectivity of the neurons is a complex project.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine, like the genome project, that map is probably different for every individual organism, even if they're of the same species.
Definitely.
Yeah. And you can say there's some similarities between these two organisms of the same species, yet that map in detail is still totally different.
Sure.
And unique, like a fingerprint.
And exactly. And just like the genetic code, the genome, there's a very high amount of similarity from individual to individual, but yet they're different, and we can identify people through their genetics. Okay, well, the other point that's important to talk about here is a thing called neuroplasticity.
Mm, I've heard about this.
Neuroplasticity means that all through our life, not just the brain cells that we were born with, we don't make a lot of brain cells later in life, but there is a lot of change that takes place in the interconnectivity. So that's how we learn. Otherwise, we couldn't learn, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we come in, we have a certain amount of brain cells, and those are actually, we have the peak number of brain cells is when we're very young. Those get pruned away, the ones that we don't need, the connections that we don't need, that we don't use, those get pruned away. They get mm-hmm. weakened, and the ones that we need and that we use get strengthened. So this is called neuroplasticity, and it accounts for learning. In other words, we learn by the changes in the strengths of signals that are sent from neuron to neuron and the changing interconnectivity of those neurons.
So literally, the more we practice, the better we get, and the more those interconnections are strengthened, whereas the sort of, if you don't use it, you lose it,
right,
is also true. If you don't learn certain things, or if you learn something young and don't use it, it slowly goes away unless you were to return and practice a lot.
Yeah, and the other little neat little way of thinking about that is those nerve cells that fire together wire together. But at any rate, now zooming out to the level of the mind, we all develop a web of beliefs that are interrelated. And that's the kinds of things that we call our worldviews, our beliefs, our opinions. And another thing to throw out here, and a lot of people have heard of this, cognitive dissonance. We tend to, when we learn new things, when we're exposed to new information, we tend to try to make it consistent with what we already know, what we already believe.
Yeah, it'd be a lot of work if it were different. I can't do that day in and day out.
I know. That's why I've always talked about prioritizing the information that we tend to want to evaluate and find its truth value. And that goes back to 1957, Leon Festinger, who was the psychologist who first did a lot of work on cognitive dissonance. So at any rate, in addition to that kind of intuitive system that we talked about, there's this system two. And how this comes into critical thinking is that system two, this deliberative analytic system that we have, by the way, which uses neurons too. It's not like system two has a whole different set of hardware.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're always talking about neurons and interconnectivity and those things that are the working units, of our cognition. But with system two, it's not that automatic. It is susceptible to input from other things that our culture can supply, and our culture supplies those as what we call algorithms.
Mm.
A recipe, a formula for doing something. An algorithm is a step-by-step procedure for getting an answer, for getting from here to there. You learned algorithms in mathematics and long division, right? Multiplication.
I learned it in programming.
definitely in programming, all right? It's big in programming. You are writing algorithms. That's what
That's
a program
right.
is. And
fortunately, I came pre-programmed.
All right. Well, the point I'm trying to make here is that where our system one is kind of wired, it doesn't mean there can't be any changes in our intuition and our intuitive system, but it's not as susceptible to change, and it's more susceptible to spitting out an answer that is kind of predictable mm-hmm. on the basis of how our intuition acts.
Sort of like autopilot.
Yeah, like autopilot. But system two is open to using these algorithms to get new information or new answers. And these algorithms, for example, are rules. Like formal logic is an algorithm. There are rules of logic.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to evaluate the logic of an argument, then you use that formal logic. So this system, too, is more what we're talking about when we're talking about critical thinking. Cost-benefit analysis is another way, taking into consideration statistical information. So this is how our culture actually affects our evolutionarily developed intuitions.
Sure, that makes sense. Different environments, different context.
Right. So that's just some groundwork that I wanted to get out there. But so we have these two brain systems, and I like Jonathan Haidt's. No, maybe it's not Jonathan Haidt. It's Joshua Green. He's another cognitive psychologist who uses the metaphor, the analogy of a camera, is that system one is like the preset settings on your camera.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're taking
autopilot.
A picture. Yeah. Taking a picture in the sunlight, you just set it to the sunlight, right?
Yeah.
And or you can turn it to manual, and then you can adjust the f-stop and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. That's more like the system, too.
Well, I don't always have the energy. I mean, I know what an ISO is, and I know what an f-stop is, but sometimes you just want to point and click. I don't have time for all that.
Yeah. Where I want to go, and I know we're taking a long time to do this little short summary. We have a call. Okay. We'll take calls in a few minutes, okay? But I do want to make the kind of final part of this summary, which is that now we don't live in this easy kind of simple world that we used to, that we've evolved this system one to. We live in a pretty complex information-laden world, and especially when the information can be misinformation or disinformation, alternative facts and all that kind of thing that we've been experiencing. So problems like global warming, or will GMO in our food supply ultimately prove to be a good thing or a bad thing? Or nuclear power, is it the best short-term measure until we are completely transitioned to renewables, or should we avoid it completely?
So there's big, important questions in the world today. It's a lot more than just being chased by tigers and looking for your next meal.
Exactly. So and they're complex. So that is a reason for being aware that a lot of our reasoning is based on this kind of emotional, preconceived, intuitive thinking. And so the case I'm trying to make here is that it's important to be aware of that and to be able to transition over to use critical thinking and to use this system two approach to examining these complex problems. And I had one thing that I wanted to say here. This is the situation that's gotten us into our present state of dead-end democracy. I just had to get that part out. And I'm advocating that we begin to learn how to deal with that.
Mm-hmm. There's something to it to say that there's pollution in our information environment, and it's really important for us as individuals to participate in that. For instance, just a really simple example, if you're going to repost something on Facebook or social media, Twitter, whatever, read it. Fact check it. Just because it has a headline you agree with doesn't mean that it should be further propagated. Take some responsibility for the information that you yourself are helping to syndicate and put out there.
I want to call that kind of approach information activism.
Yeah.
We can stop this kind of thing that has been occurring with the polarization. You believe the source that matches your values, your preset ideas. Mm-hmm. You believe everything they say and think everything the people who are in opposition are saying is lies.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of thing that we've gotten into. It's a polarization based on emotional arguments, preconceived ideas about the way the world is. And I think, and I'm advocating that we all become informational activists by doing just what you said.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't do that with everything.
No, not everything. You got to pick your topics.
You got to pick your topics. But you do not have to pass on that information that you have not evaluated just because you agree with it, even if and have not checked it out.
Mm-hmm.
It may be completely wrong. So I think we have Brad on the telephone.
Well,
hi, Brad.
All right.
Hello, how you doing?
Good.
Hi, Brad. Thanks for giving us a call.
I just had a question. Did you ever read about anything like from Einstein? One of his greatest fears was?
No. Do you know what one of...
The day that man's technology would interact, would surpass his ability to interact with it.
I never heard that before.
It was one of Einstein's greatest fears, from what I read in a book.
Well, a number of people in terms of artificial intelligence are having that same fear, you know, artificial intelligence and the downside that may be if it ever comes to be.
Well, actually, Microsoft had what they call learning chatbots. They use machine learning, and they were basically programmed to carry on a conversation. Two of the chatbots started conversing with each other, and in that machine learning conversation, invented their own language that no one else understood. And that's when they shut down that program.
Wow.
So that did happen.
Yeah,
that's a thing we're all paying attention to.
You know, last time I was in the Bay Area, I noticed three or four, was it maybe, self-driving cars, you know, with people in them, and a guy sitting there playing with a laptop, but he wasn't driving it. You know, he was just playing with a laptop, you know. I mean, it was probably driving the car, but he wasn't steering the car.
Yeah, cool.
You know, manually. And they look like they have speakers on the outside of the car, like stuck with the magnets, you know. They're usually Toyotas or Hondas. You know, I've seen a number of them in Palo Alto mostly.
Yeah, well,
on Highway 280.
I appreciate
you. You probably have other callers. I just wanted to know if you knew what Einstein's greatest fear was.
Well, it's also Stephen Hawking's greatest fear, and a number of people who are worried about that. And basically, I think it's something that maybe we ought to have as a future topic on the show.
Ooh.
Because my feeling about that is that our culture drastically lags behind our technology. We have very powerful technologies out there, but our culture, it ought to be our way of using that in a productive, safe way that's going to help our future. And we're kind of clueless about, you know, how to deal with some of these. We're making some strides. The new CRISPR technology.
The gene editor.
The gene editor.
I heard they put a song in somebody's genes. I heard that.
I've got a song in my genes.
They did. They put some kind of, I don't know.
Well, yeah,
I saw it on Facebook.
I don't know. I haven't heard that one, but they are the thing with that CRISPR technology is it's a very powerful technique that is very apparently easy to use, and people are worried. The people who developed the technology are calling for lots of communication and conversation because they don't want it to come out the same way that GMO and some of the other technologies came out. They want people to to see what their objections are and to build oversight agencies and things like that and regulation into that technology. So, I mean, that's what I'm talking about is our culture has the ability to take a smart approach to technology.
Like to dictate the technology, you know, it should mimic the technology, really, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much, Brad.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Caller. I think we might have another caller on the line. We're working on that.
Do we have another caller, Eric? Okay. Welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hello, caller.
Yes.
Yeah, you're on the air.
Oh, I'm on the air. Okay.
You are.
All right. Where do the emotions come from?
Where do emotions come from?
Yeah. Where do the emotions come from in relation to the brain?
They come from the interconnectivity of the neurons.
I mean, as opposed to
everything does.
Emotions are feelings.
Yes, and
it's a little bit separate from thought.
Well, thought and emotion are both considered cognition. The general term is cognition, and that covers thought and emotion. Emotions develop according to current cognitive science. Develop the same way that thoughts develop. I mean, they develop through the interconnection of neurons. And some emotions were pre-programmed into human beings, pre-wired just as they are in other animals. And some emotions may be mixtures of certain basic emotions, but it's according to cognitive science, it's all neurons and the interconnectivity of neurons.
Because, you know, the feelings you feel angry, you feel passion,
yes.
feel, you know, it's different, that thinking is kind of a step away where you're thinking thoughts about what you're feeling, and it's an intellectual level rather than feelings are more like intuitive.
Have you ever thought about somebody and got angry at them? You thought about them, a conversation that you had with them. You thought about the body language that you remember them having, and you actually started to feel an emotion like anger, or maybe joy and love.
Have you
had that experience?
I suppose so.
Okay, that's the connection between thoughts and emotion.
You think about somebody, and then you have a feeling or a thought about them. When you remember something they said that made you feel happy or sad or angry, is that what you're saying?
Well, like I'm thinking about what's going on in Puerto Rico, you know, and the news updates I've heard and the situation and environment people must be in there. And I mean, it brings up a lot of emotions and feelings in me, I think.
Yeah.
Isn't that?
But thinking just seems to be a little bit different. And I just wondered how. You know, I suppose it all comes from the brain, but I know, like, psychotherapists, like, they'll ask you, you know, what are you feeling, rather than if you're, you know, you think this and you think that, and they go, yeah, but what are you feeling? Because that has more to do with what's actually going on, maybe, on a deeper level than just the thoughts, which are more abstract.
Well, sure. That's what we talked about in the System 1, is that it's more connected to our emotions, but it doesn't mean that those emotions come from some magical place other than...
I'm not talking about a magical place at all.
And by the way, psychotherapists who say, what are you feeling? I hate that when psychotherapists do that, because most psychotherapists don't do that. That's the way they do it on TV.
No, that's not true.
Well,
I don't know how much psychotherapy you've had. So there's no time to get into that right
well,
now.
Well, 30 years as a counselor, I understand that. It's just that I don't want to get off on this subject.
Well, what you feel is important.
But
sometimes it's more important than what you think, because what you think might be more abstract than what you're
feeling. I'm not quibbling with that, but I just say this. I don't want to get too far off on this, but it's always better for a therapist or counselor or therapist, psychotherapist, whatever you want to call them, to watch your body language and to have some idea of what it is, and to do that kind of reflective listening, saying, I can see your eyes are moistening and that this really has some powerful impact to you. Because if a therapist says to you, what are you feeling? And you're feeling an intense emotion, it means that therapist just doesn't have a clue. So, you know, I used to tell people, if a therapist says, what are you feeling, you better get another therapist. But
well,
that's
way if you're
up.
Talking about something in an abstract way and you're not dealing with what you're actually feeling, you might be avoiding it.
Yeah, but see, I'm not saying to deny the feelings. I'm saying the therapist ought to have some inkling as to what the feeling is and to use empathy to help bring those feelings
out. Yeah, but they can't always tell what you're feeling if they don't, you know, ask you to explore your own feelings.
I'm just going to throw out there. I think we're getting a little into the weeds
we
of
are.
Okay, therapy.
Okay. Anyway,
but
I just wanted to know
it's
about
an interesting,
the brain.
It's
and,
an interesting
you know,
idea,
how, are there areas of the brain that deal with emotions that are different than
yes.
areas of
the
brain the that
limbic
deal with?
The limbic system. They have identified certain regions in the brain that are more highly tied to emotional ideas or emotionality, yes.
And I just want to make the clarifying point that I understand our show is Thinking Clearly, and it is about critical thinking.
It's not about feeling clearly, right?
No, but hang on. The point I want to make is that we're not saying emotions are bad or you shouldn't feel or that they shouldn't be factors in your decision making. We're just saying that there are certain times you want to employ critical thinking more than other times. Sitting with your counselor or your therapist is probably not one of those times.
Well, I mean, that's really not terribly related to what I was talking about. But yes, thinking clearly, you want to be able to think clearly and maybe step away from what you're feeling and think about what's going on to be able to think critically.
Yeah.
So anyway, I won't take up any more
okay.
of your time.
No.
You.
Thank you for calling.
Thanks, caller.
And we have
Sean
on the line.
Sean's on the line. Hello, Sean.
Welcome, Sean.
Hello, Sean.
How's it going?
Good. How are you? You have a question for us?
Okay. enjoying this fall weather, but it's kind of dry. I can't even have fires around.
I know.
It gets cold. You got to get the propane heater out.
Dare I but hope my, for some rain soon.
My really concern is just that oceanography of the global warming and glacier melt. My really concern is the glacier melt. Why not have desaltation? And there's droughts in America. Of course, there's in California, we're going to get a drought again because we haven't had any rain at all in September. Well, I'm very like a drop in the bucket. So my concern is to have why not have desaltation plants to irrigate lands that are in a drought?
Okay, that's a great question. I don't know that much about it, but what are some ideas you might have? Like what, since this is a topic of interest to you, if you were to put yourself in that position, what are some of the reasons you could come up with just speculating that desalination might not be, effective or why we're not doing it? Do you have any ideas or have you?
Well, the cost is one thing, but the thing is that the ends justify the means, in that if there's global warming and the icebergs are melting and the sea level is rising, why not convert that seawater into irrigation? Therefore, eliminating having drought issues.
Well, what we're trying to do then, the topic on this show is not so much the content of these ideas, and I got a little off on the content myself here, but it is more the process of how you go about, if you're faced with some information that you're seeing, that global warming doesn't exist. You run across and you're having a discussion with someone who,
like Donald Trump, thinks it does.
Exactly.
That it does.
You know, so when you're faced with that, how do you deal with that information, and how do you listen to the person's arguments, and how do you evaluate the arguments? That's basically
what
we're
trying to do. Well, you deal with Donald Trump saying, "Look, sir, there's a drought in California. Like, for example, we don't have any rain in October and November. We're in a drought again. As a matter of fact, our ponds are dry. They're just down."
So you would use...
What I'm saying is that the Trump administration to say that there's a solution, and the solution is desaltation plants to irrigate the farmers, and at the same time it lowers the potential of flooding or just seawater rising.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay, so you would offer some, let's get back on the process now, you would offer some rebuttal arguments to, if you're talking to Donald Trump or some other global warming...
or just anybody.
Yeah, or anybody who is denying.
In my opinion, he's reluctant.
Okay, so we're going to just stick with the process. So the way you would react to that is you would offer some rebuttal arguments to the rebuttal, and it sounds like your arguments are based on what you see around you, what you observe, your experience.
Yeah, the solution. I'm offering a solution. I'm not trying to be pessimistic or anything, but, a glass of water is either half empty or half full. In ex post facto, non qualibus magenta sunt, as they say in Latin, which means after the fact that things do not appear always what they seem,
mm-hmm.
Solution is
okay.
It could be the problem. Desaltation could irrigate. It could work wonders for California with great fields. And
all right, so your process is to offer some rebuttal arguments and a solution. See, that's what we're trying
that's
to
correct.
Do. That's what we're trying to do is keep focused on the process. So I think we have another caller. Thank you very much. This is Jesse. It's you. You're on the line. Welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hello, Jesse.
Oh, thank you. I admire the concept. So
what's on your mind, Jesse?
The issue that I would like to raise and that I'm confronted and my community are confronted with and have been for the last 40, 50 years is water, clean water, and the Clean Water Act. And then also now coming into focus is climate change. And what I see is that the entities, the agencies that are charged with maintaining our rivers and water supply clean and healthy and, you know, providing habitat, have failed increasingly over this period of time. They've missed each deadline, you know, 1987, 1993, you know, I mean, each time they've missed it and things have gotten worse. They are charged with transparency, responsiveness, accountability, and some other concepts. But it seems like they always are able to kick the can down the road. And can you describe what goes on in our brains that, you know, how do we process these failures and then come out with just longer and longer time schedules for, say, recovering water quality or reducing the channel infill that causes flooding? Or I'd be very interested in your thoughts there. Is there a mental defect, you know, that's widespread among, you know, people that participate in making these decisions?
Well, it bears on what we've been introducing as topic here, which is confirmation bias. Confirmation bias means that if people are denying some of these things that other people are seeing, that's one very big aspect of what we call motivated reasoning. Motivated reasoning is having a prior conclusion and then looking for evidence to support that conclusion, rather than weighing the whole range of evidence and evaluating each piece of evidence separately to see which is good evidence and supports the conclusion. Motivated reasoner, somebody who's engaging in motivated reasoning rather than critical thinking, will have a preconceived idea, conclusion, and they're looking for support for that. So they're ignoring evidence that does not support their conclusion, and they're accepting evidence, even if it's weak, that does support it. So that's called confirmation bias or some motivated reasoning, and that's the present explanation for why it's hard to have these kinds of discussions with people who are 180 degrees out of what you believe. So that's a large part of what we're talking about tonight.
I would go a slightly different direction with the caller's question.
Go ahead.
First, I would try and tease apart groups of people and individuals, because the caller mm-hmm. was first talking about water and agencies, but not individual people. And there's a sort of groupthink that goes on.
Mm-hmm.
Groups of people have their own systems.
Right.
In place. One of those things that's really common in groups of people is that there's usually a default,
mm-hmm.
and people want to, they don't want to deviate from that default. You don't want to be the person who rocks the boat. So it is very common when people become indoctrinated into a group or that they're going to becoming a part of that group is in fact doing what that group does. So I would take it at a slightly different angle and saying what I heard in your question was more questions about systemic change versus the individual bias.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you've made a very good point that, you know, the agencies follow procedural, you know, law. They're required to follow a procedure.
Mm-hmm.
And that procedure is, like somebody was saying earlier, I mean, the culture is way behind what the procedure is. And then when I hear myself say that, I realize that, no, these goals were set back in 1974 and, you know, 27, and they've never been attained. And the procedures were there. You know, you were to recover the water, you know, the water quality by such and such a date. So the agencies don't follow the procedure, and the groupthink doesn't follow the procedure. I agree with the framing that it's motivated decision making.
Well, yeah, there's two issues. One is that the procedures themselves should be science-based. The policy should be science-based, not politically based, but science-based, or at least heavily influenced by the science. And secondly, an agency, if they have a set of procedures, then it sounds like just a internal problem if the agency is actually not following that.
And you'd think that when they get it wrong for 30 years, and people's entire lives are disrupted by this getting it wrong, you know, floodwaters in your house, your water supply just completely polluted, that after 30 years of watching people suffer that the agency would go, wait a minute, we're accountable. We've got to be responsive. We've got to take responsibility for this. We can't just, you know, keep kicking the can down the road because we want to accommodate important economic.
There's another interesting phenomenon in social psychology, which is the more people that are present, the less likely it is that any individual is going to do anything.
Yeah.
So
diffusion of responsibility. It's a complex question. It's a complex answer, and we're just about out of time. In fact, we are out of time, Jesse. So thank you very much for the call, and thank you, everyone, for the calls.
Great callers.
Yeah, and we got a fourth of the way through one of the topics in the show. We're just going to have to continue this one sometime.
That's right.
But hopefully next month we'll have a researcher from UC Irvine, Dr. Ditto or Dr. Ditto. I'm not sure how you pronounce his name, but we'll be talking about motivated reasoning with him. Yes. With Bob and Juliet.
This is Thinking Clearly.
Bye-bye.
Free for yourself, little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan. Cause everyone's lost, chin deep in the sand. And what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD, People-Powered Radio.